Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Fanan, Director of Content at Steinway. If you enjoy Soundboard, please rate, review, and subscribe to it wherever you pod your casts. My guest today is the pianist Alexandre Cantereau. He's the winner of the 2019 International Tchaikovsky Competition and winner of the 2024 Gilmour Artist Award. You come from a bit of a classical music family. Parents are both violinists, your father conducts. So I'm wondering, apart from some talent and some genes, I wonder what you learned from them early on about this music.
Oh, you learn so much. A lot of it you don't realize until a long time has passed, and then you reflect on it and you realize how much they unconsciously brought to you. But I know the fact that I was hearing my dad constantly work on his violin. I would go to concerts. I think I would also pick up a bit on certain musical ideas they had, because they talked always about music. And I remember even just the fact that on the violin, you do things in a very natural way, because you've got this string, and when you go higher, it's more challenging, so there's more tension. On the piano, you're really on this instrument where you have to artificially recreate a lot of organic things that are natural in voices in string instruments. And I think a lot of the sounds I would hear and the timing between certain notes came from my dad practicing. So a lot. And also, of course, the feeling of belonging to a very natural musical family. And it extends to the feeling also of concert is a natural thing and a natural environment. So there's a lot that came from that, of course.
You made an interesting point that I've heard other pianists talk about. I'm thinking of Steinway artist Paul Lewis. He was playing Pictures at an Exhibition on the piano. And he said that he always thinks of the piano as an orchestra, and he tries to break up the octaves into different orchestral sections. And you're talking about the limitations of the piano as this percussion instrument at the end of the day, and treating it more like the voice and more like the violin. I wonder if you could speak a little bit to how you actually do that.
The thing is, like you said, it's a percussive instrument, and you have a sort of infinite possibilities of variations on very little parameters. You can control the way you attack a key, the way you let go of it, and the time you take between two notes, and the pedal that is a bit like Rachmaninoff would say, the soul of the piano. And with just these things, I think the more you have of variations on these little things, the better it becomes, because the more you have at your disposal really colors, you create expression by sometimes putting the right hand before the left hand a little bit, you create different levels of sound, and you try and adapt on each pieces. Yeah, these pieces that are very much symphonies in disguise. Brahms's first sonatas are a bit like that. And there it's very clear that you feel that there were instruments in mind, like Paul Lewis said, in different registers. And the horns are very clear because they work with the intervals of sixes and thirds. And you get that really when you hear passages that are built like that. You really know this sound is meant to be like that. And otherwise, then some pieces, you maybe it's not an orchestra, maybe it's more of a ballet, an opera, and it's about the sort of structure and how you these waves of sounds achieve one high culminating point, and you must be quite careful to balance it out so we feel the structure. A lot of trying out, a lot of experimentation before, and even sometimes if you really believe the piece has a certain soul, you can even try and arrange the text so that you can bring out the musical idea you had. There's a lot that I try out in rehearsals and preparation, and then there's the moment on stage where a lot of the big problems get resolved also instinctively, because you understand on stage things that you couldn't before, and then you reflect on that and you grow with the piece. I think there's a bit of a balance between this instinct and all the preparation and the tryouts you can make.
I think that's an excellent point. Until you're playing it on stage, this is all theoretical, right?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, there's so much about time you can't realize, or a lot of passages that you worked a lot for not much of a reason, because on stage they are very, very natural, and the opposite is true. There's a lot of big traps and big moments that fail on stage because you treated them too lightly. And yeah, there's the amount of adrenaline that you have, and your body reacts to that. And so you play a certain way that is very different. And yeah, so certain things unlock themselves when an audience comes in. It's quite magical.
And I imagine as a professional, the more you play, the more you practice, the more you understand what will be time well spent, and also the more you can channel this adrenaline so that it becomes helpful and not harmful.
Hopefully, when good days, yeah, exactly. That's I think one of the struggles. It's at the same time frustrating, and at the same time it ensures that probably you could do that all your life without feeling the boredom come, because you can't really be secure on anything at a level where you know that you can reproduce the same thing and it will 100% work, or this intention, you will always manage to bring it on stage. There's always surprises, and good and bad, and you have to unfortunately or fortunately deal with that.
Maybe it doesn't change. I remember this interview with Frank Sinatra, and he said before he sings, every time before he goes on stage, he gets terrified. And I mean, you think of a guy who seems so natural. Maybe that stage fright is healthy, and maybe it's always there.
Yeah. It's, I know every personality, but there's, yeah, of course, so many stories of musicians that are terrified, even when they are legends and when you feel that they have a mastery of their instrument. And yeah, it's really the way our sort of psychological system is built. Some have really no pressure at all. It's really a sort of accumulation of childhood trauma and lots of stuff that could happen on stage and your relationship to people that you cannot control. But of course, if you are, I would say, creative enough and searching and curious enough, I think you find ways so that you, like you said, it starts to become a helpful tool. And even when if it puts you in a state of a more dangerous state, you get things out of this state that are quite unique and that make you a better musician in a way.
Speaking of bringing new terrifying things to the stage, I know that you're working on a recital program.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could take us into the process of how you determine what's in a recital and how you find a through line between perhaps seemingly disparate pieces.
Well, for this recital, I think one of the main focuses was the Metzner piece, this Metzner sonata. I did a few recitals with the use of the Brahms early sonatas, and I wanted to change, and I really went into the Metzner's works, and I realized how much, well, he's only writing for piano. He wrote so many sonatas, and he's one of the true last romantics that still keeps very intact the legacy that of what comes before and pushes it to the limit of poetry and expands it into really interesting structures. And this first sonata is a big homage to all the music of the past. It's really an homage to Bach, because there's a huge amount of counterpoint and voices that are very clear. It's not big chords like Rachmaninoff. Everything is much more detailed and audible. Every voice is clear. There's, of course, a lot of Beethoven, a journey to darkness, to light, big focus on the last movement that brings back all the themes and that concludes it. You've got Chopin melodies. And so I found it was very interestingly built and rich. And it's a very obsessive piece. And that's why most of the pieces of this recital deal quite a bit much with a sort of form of obsession. I wanted to play Bach and the variations on the Weidenklagen's organ, Sagen, is this almost mantra that was used for him as a symbol of the Christ dying on the cross. He uses it in his Mass in B minor. And Liszt created this overblown piece of labyrinthic where you're doomed into this nightmare that repeats itself. And Liszt added the brilliant idea at the end to resolve this by another call of Barbe, that that's really sort of a moment of clarity, and it brings a huge amount of joy. And from that, the last Beethoven sonata also brought myself in my mind, because they function in very opposite ways. One is a huge, like Bach is a huge journey into this nightmare that is resolved only at the end, and Beethoven is a bit the opposite. It's a huge storm of darkness, but then there's an enormous, most of the piece is bathed in light, and it feels very much this duality of man falling out of heaven and then climbing back slowly. And with Beethoven, you always feel the struggle of man that's achieving higher things, and you see every obstacle on the way. And then there was a few pieces to complement them. I think Scriabin is one of the composers that also has this obsession of, like Beethoven in his last pieces, of trills, this sort of mystical chords and very very spiritual ideas that come forward. And so, yeah, the whole program was constructed around Metzner, and I tried to balance them into very different styles and genres of composers, but to try and still make it a bit unified.
The Metzner and the Scriabin, are these part of your continued Russian focus?
I think from now on, I'm going to try and play a bit more Metzner, definitely in the next recitals. Scriabin, I've played very little. Again, also, I think it could be one of the very interesting composers to start, really. This piece that I'm playing here, Vers la Flamme, is really just a sort of concentrated version of what he would do in his sonatas, where he has much more time to unfold his ideas. But it's a very good gateway into Scriabin's music, especially his last works, because you get in such a clear way his obsession of these chords, and it's just a few melodic ideas and harmonic ideas that are built and taken to huge heights with this burning into flames and these trills that repeat themselves. So you get a sort of apocalyptic vision in a very naturalistic way.
Yeah, Scriabin was a bit more out there than Metzner.
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
But interesting how you see this bridge from Bach to 20th century in Metzner.
It's, I think, interesting to see that all the composers first of all, used the music of what came before. And also, at the same time, they deal with the same struggles and the same big themes and big questions of humanity. And so you can actually very easily find a lot of similarities between people that are hundreds of years apart. It's quite beautiful to see how much they can be close in that way.
Alexandre, does each of these composers require a different set of priorities when you're studying or learning their music, or do you use the same approach for each?
Well, of course, there are certain bases that you keep probably intact, but most of the time it's not even in between the same composers, but every piece, composers have changed so much, and they change their musical priorities. And then you open up a score and after a bit of analyzing it, playing it a bit on the piano, having ideas, there are ideas that comes to mind, and you understand also what is very comfortable for you naturally, what is very instinctive and works, and where are the things where you are very separate from this music and you need to get closer and to attach yourself really, and that requires quite a bit of time and work. And it's more of a question of trying to resolve the questions of the score. There's a lot that is written, there's a lot that is not written, there's a lot that you can guess by knowing a bit the other works of a composer, or building a bit of a knowledge of a sort of fake character that you would know when you imagine a composer. And slowly then you try to get closer to it. And of course, you change also. So when you come back to a piece, you'll probably play it in a very different way. But I think, yeah, every piece, you get the same amount of not understanding everything and trying to search and trying to resolve some questions.
It's true that not only can composers change their character from piece to piece, but I think our relationships with those composers change as well. Right now, you're working on Prokofiev's Third Piano Concerto. I wonder how your relationship has changed with him as you dive into that piece.
I've only played before the second piano concerto, which is a hugely dark extremist work that pushes really the player to the limits. It's really, in the way it's written, you really see this form of extremism. And this concerto, it's funny because at the same time, it's a hugely virtuosic piece. At the other time, when you look at the score, it's very fascinating how moderate it is. He writes only very little indications. He doesn't write extreme nuances that, like in the second, I was really surprised how much was not in what I imagined. First, it was very also difficult to start this piece when you've listened so much to it. I mean, to dissociate yourself from the interpretations of Martha Argerich, for example, who made this piece so famous. There's a bit of a period of going really to be sure that you're going to start from scratch and unlearning all that you've heard in your mind and the traditions that you have in your head. And then as I started, I love this balance that he has between, at the same time, he's an extremely lyrical composer and it's an extremely lyrical piece. He's really like the Romeo and Juliet ballet, full of legends, full of fairy tales, so very characteristic pieces that you have to switch from all these sections where you switch characters very quickly. And this also very modernistic, a bit industrial way with this sort of machine and momentum that never stops. And so you get a bit of this balance between the modernity and these traditions in this piece that I love. I was surprised also how much the orchestra gives you the heartbeat of the piece during the whole time. There are always the basses giving you this beat so that you build blocks with the orchestra. It's quite surprising. And then on the moment, playing it a little bit, I realized also that for all the good ideas in theory, then there's a lot you have to bring energy-wise to still make it convincing. And that I had to learn the hard way by playing it.
It's that old strategy and execution combination we were talking about earlier. Yeah.
Exactly, yes.
Alexandre, you've been playing piano for more than, I'd say, 20 years now. Was there a significant lesson from a teacher in your life that changed the way you approached music or approached the piano?
I think there were a few, but the first person to actually show me the powers of interpretation, probably. I think I was 11 or 12, and at that time, I just liked sight reading pieces, and that's it. And he was he's called Igor Lascaux, is a teacher that is in Paris. And he gave me really the first amount of responsibility that you have with a piece, that it's on your shoulders to make it to make this piece shine in a special light. And you have to make the connection between the piece and the audience. And he was the first one to put this responsibility in me. And probably then also, I still see her from time to time. She's called Rena Shereshevskaya. And, she's this teacher that balances very well the concrete aspects to very easy lessons that she can tell you that have immediate results. And at the same time, this search that would never stop. She would spend her days looking through scores, changing her ideas, creating these almost mystical symbolic connections between, for example, she would be sure that Bach passions, every composer would know what every theme would mean symbolically and would reuse them. So when you see these combinations of notes, they all mean the same thing. And there's this map that unfolds. She has this sort of very symbolic approach to music. But I saw also the great power in building these symbols, and even in your mind, even if they are false, but to have the belief and the will inside of you when you truly believe the way the score is written, I think it produces quite powerful results in the way you play.
The search that will never stop. I hope we can all be blessed,
yeah,
to have that level of energy and inspiration. Yeah. Passez un excellent séjour en Normandie. J'espère Merci. Que vous profiterez d'un beau soleil.
Wow.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. Our opening and closing music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush on a Steinway Model M, played by me, Ben Finan. Question for the podcast? Email me at info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Message me on Facebook at Steinway or hit me on the gram at Steinway & Sons. Subscribe to Soundboard on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, or wherever you pod your casts. Thank you for listening.